Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to EIR Talks. It's Tuesday, November 6, 2001, and this is Tony Papert. Today's show will feature a dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche and a special report from New Federalist editor Nancy Spanis on an in-depth homeland defense against biological warfare. First, let me discuss in general how a war on terrorism can actually be won. On September 11th, President Bush declared war on terrorism wherever it exists around the world. He was immediately supported and joined by leaders of almost all nations in the world, with the first being Russia's President Putin, who telephoned Bush, as you probably remember, on the morning of September 11th. But since then, on October 7th, we've gone to war in Afghanistan. This Afghanistan war cannot be won. It threatens to be a repeat of Vietnam and Korea, only worse. It's America's third land war in Asia during the 21st century, after those two. Worse, it threatens to pin down our government and immobilize it as the financial system sinks out of control, and immobilize our government from acting against a threat of war in the Mideast, spreading into a general clash of civilizations, the threat from the crazies in the Israeli Defense Forces. The Afghanistan war also destabilizes other countries in the area, as is well known. That no-win war has to be ended and a real war against terrorism begun. But to do that, we have to face some facts. Remember that as the attacks were going on September 11th, Lyndon LaRouche was being interviewed on a radio show by Jack Stockwell. At that time, as the attacks were going on, LaRouche forecast that Osama bin Laden would be blamed for it, even though there was absolutely no evidence. That happened almost immediately, and that's been the subject of a multi-million dollar PR campaign in the weeks since. What LaRouche pointed out is that Osama bin Laden and the Afghan terrorists did not have the capability to bring off this type of attack, that the command came from rogue elements inside the United States military and security establishment, and possibly that of other leading countries as well, not Afghanistan. International terrorism, of course, exists. But international terrorism is, as LaRouche had said, a hiring hall. You have to look for who is doing the hiring. And in this case, it's an enemy within. Now, LaRouche's analysis from that morning of September 11th has since been confirmed in several ways. It's been confirmed by the anthrax attacks here in the U.S., which is generally admitted could not have come from Afghanistan or other foreign terrorist sources, but came from here. Lynn's analysis, LaRouche's analysis, is also confirmed by the activities of the Blair government of Great Britain in the weeks following September 11th. Remember that the Blair government cheered the United States on into the war in Afghanistan, saying it wanted to lead a war against terrorism, even though Blair's London is the leading safe house for world terrorism and the leading conduit for terrorist financing. So what we've got to do is engage a real war against terrorism, get out of the mire and swamp of Afghanistan, just get quietly and quickly out of there, and also get out of the embrace of Britain's Tony Blair. Now, the major thing we have to do here is outflank the Terrorist International by shutting down its funding. First of all, that means shutting down the drug trade internationally. The drug trade is the source of funding for terrorism, illustrated, for instance, by the fact that 80% of the heroin in Europe and Asia comes from the poppy fields of Afghanistan. The EIR showed in research in 1995 that at that time, the international drug trade amounted to about $500 billion per year. The most recent Department of Justice report in 2001 shows that the drug trade has grown since. So it would appear if you take the drug trade, combine it with a rapidly growing international illegal weapons trade, you're talking about something over $1 trillion a year, much of it available for financing the narco-terrorist international. Now, the drug trade can easily be wiped out if we move on it. NASA satellites, for instance, are capable of locating every cocaine, opium, marijuana field in the world. They can be wiped out by targeted pesticides, which cause no environmental damage. Rigid controls at national borders, of the type actually that we've instituted since September 11th, can wipe out the greater part of the drug trade crossing borders, as already the flow into the United States from Mexico over our southern border has been drastically curtailed because of border controls since September 11th. But the only way the war on drugs can be won is if you go after the citizens above suspicion who provide the money laundering facilities for the drug traffickers. This is a global money laundering system, laundering in actually in excess of $1 trillion a year, which is located in our decentralized, deregulated commercial banking system and the derivatives trading outfits or hedge funds, which are generally run by the major commercial banks. We have to tell George Soros, the mega speculator and hedge fund operator, that he's going to be brought to justice. We have to tell Richard Grasso, the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, who went down to Colombia to embrace the narco-terrorists of the FARC, literally embrace them, that his dreams of narco-dollars bailing out the New York Stock Exchange are not going to happen. On this question, the Bush administration reversed itself after September 11th and supported what is in many respects effective money laundering legislation of the sort which they had previously opposed. So legislation against money laundering passed both houses of Congress in the week of October 22nd and was signed into law as part of a package of so-called anti-terrorism measures. There was a fierce fight on the package which did pass. Lobbies for the insurance companies and the big banks were insisting that various provisions be excluded. In some cases they won, in some cases they lost. Dick Armey, the majority leader of the House, insisted that financial inflows from offshore money laundering centers like the Cayman Islands be excluded from control because he said citizens were using these to evade taxes, and evading taxes is sound economics. Nevertheless, there were some controls introduced over those offshore centers, of which the major ones are British Crown colonies like the Channel Islands, the Isle of Man. In a groundbreaking development, the new legislation permits the Secretary of the Treasury to prohibit foreign banks from doing business in the U.S. if they refuse to cooperate against money laundering. Although one of the problems of the legislation is, as in the hunt for bin Laden, in fact, it tends to look for the problem overseas, whereas it's well known that our big New York banks compete very effectively for their share of the money laundering. Citibank, for instance, has laundered perhaps $200 billion for Raul Salinas, the brother of the ex-president of Mexico, and nothing to this date has been done about it. However, that among the steps taken, concentration accounts in foreign banks were made illegal. Concentration accounts were accounts which merged monies of various depositors for the purpose of wiring them anonymously. There are greater controls over cash deposits in banks and more regulations that banks have to know their customers. The glaring weakness in the bill is that it mandates that before enforcing any of these provisions, the Secretary of the Treasury has to consult with the Federal Reserve if he feels that enforcement might destabilize a bank, destabilize the financial system as a whole, or create a competitive problem for a U.S. bank. This is potentially a barn door in the legislation. Our financial system is gone. Anything that happens will destabilize it further. We have to forget about saving this rotten financial system and actually go on to win the war against terrorism. Another weakness is that hedge funds, like those of George Soros, are excluded from the legislation. Nevertheless, it's a start. We have to insist on rigorous enforcement while closing up the loopholes in the legislation just passed by Congress. Now, for another major flank on the war against terrorism, let's turn to a special report by New Federalist editor Nancy Spanas on a homeland defense in depth against bioterrorism.
This is Nancy Spanas for the LaRouche Connection. With the outbreak of the anthrax cases hitting all around the country on top of the September 11th calamity, Americans are understandably agitated about the ability of their government to take care of their defense. 2004 Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche addressed this topic on October 28th in a statement he entitled, A National Defense Against Germ Warfare. In that statement, LaRouche argues that the crucial elements of such a defense are those measures of sanitation which are essential to the well-being of the population as a whole. This includes those measures and institutionalized practice which modern society has come to consider public sanitation. This includes not only safe water, but also improved supplies of energy per capita and per square kilometer. This at declining relative costs to communities, industries, and the general public. It also includes improved public transportation. Our nation used to understand how to carry out such a defense, LaRouche argues. The lessons we learned in World War II, for example, and the Korean War, were implemented in our adoption of the Hill-Burton legislation, adopted in 1946. That legislation called for providing a certain standard of health care in facilities and personnel per unit population, and without restriction as to the ability to pay. That's common sense, because if you don't give health care to the poor, they will be the first to get new infections and to be a danger to us all. To that end, LaRouche stressed, public teaching hospitals, like DC General Hospital, must be reopened immediately. As to the anthrax attacks per se, LaRouche argues that we must prepare for the worst, but aim for the best. So far, the impact of these attacks has been primarily of the character of psychological warfare, intended to terrify us into accepting the coup d'etat which began September 11th. But there is no assurance that the coup plotters who launched that attack are going to limit themselves to psy war. More devastating blows against our nation's vital infrastructure must be expected until the still unknown plotters have been defeated. The most essential element toward defeating the coup, LaRouche argues, will be building up the national defense through a shift of the federal government policy toward a coordinated crash effort of reconstructing institutions that serve our general welfare. On October 31st, the meeting of the Coalition for a New D.C. General Hospital met in Washington, D.C., as it does every week, and this time they heard EIR economics editor Marcia Mary Baker presents the basic picture of how we've taken down our public health defense over the past 30 years and what can be done to rebuild it now. We turn to her presentation.
I want to begin with the word called sanitation. Lynn Speed was just reading. You think, what are we going to do, take a big gallon of Clorox and clean the whole country? I mean, or spray some lice? What is it? Sanitation. But that's the right word about the full defense of a community or of a nation. When you think of what has to be sanitary, you need to rely on your water, food, and if something comes along that you pick up, you can pick it up from animals or somewhere else, rabies, remember, you know, anything. You need to have laboratories, and you need to have that hospital there, and you need to have specialty clinics if that comes up. What I want to do is deal with four areas, taking off from the word sanitation, in terms of a word you often hear, infrastructure, just meaning, well, I didn't look at the dictionary, but infra, I think, means within the city, the district, or within your community, or within our nation. What structures have we got on water and food and the beginning with the hospital, but also the laboratories, the staff, because this flagship fight here in Washington is, we're at a special point about infrastructure for our whole nation. And what I'll conclude with, I'm jumping the gun, is we go and reopen things, build things anew, and that's the jobs that we now don't have. Back again with the vengeance, that's the restoration of the whole country. So, but we can start with looking, I want to go back and forth in history in these four areas of hospitals, food, and so forth and so forth. I mentioned I'm going to begin with hospitals. But I'm going to go back 50, 60 years before the Second World War. We were talking about the Second World War. Here you look at the country. We're here in the District of Columbia, a world city like Philadelphia or Baltimore. But you know how many counties we have in the country? That's what's up here. 3,064, I think. Before the Second World War, those areas that are dark, they had no community hospital. N-O, no community hospital. Now, some of the community hospitals... notice where there were a lot of community hospitals, up here in the northeast, but these other counties had none, especially in the south and some of the remote areas of the west. Some of those hospitals, of course, were white only, restricted to black, this and that. But I mean, when it's dark there, they had no hospital at all, okay? So we took the Second World War as a benchmark. Lynn Speed just mentioned that. Let's go from there, because a certain experience about mobilizing your nation and everything else, hospitals were built after that period. I didn't bring an illustration, but it was 1946 in August that was enacted, I mentioned it before, a little nine-page law called Hospital Survey and Construction Act, sponsored by Senator Lister Hill, named Listerine was named after a hero of his father's, Lister, for sanitation. Senator Lister Hill from Alabama and a Senator Harold Burton from Ohio or somewhere, and they said we ought to have a hospital in every county of our nation. District of Columbia, since 1806, had District D.C. General, I believe. But we need one in every county of the nation. And they were built. And by 1950, 1955, 1960, up through 1970, every county was getting a hospital. And here you see, then... in the last 25 years, culminating in D.C. General being shut down, they started to be shut down. There was a shift away from this look, the way things were looking after the Second World War, hopefully ahead. There was a shift about 30 years ago where they said, oh, we have to have the markets decide. We can't spend too much money. We can't do this and that. Here's the figures. 1975, we have reached nationwide over 5,000, close to 5,600 hospitals, one for every county, one for every 3,000 county. In fact, it went up. Then the number of hospitals went down, which means the number of beds went down in the country. That's in 850,000, 900,000. Just look at the trend. We're not going to spend a lot of time. But you see what happened. We had an outlook to say we have to have hospitals. Another way to look at it is availability. You have anthrax. Say you don't have anthrax. Say you have a plane crash. Someone mentioned a train crash. Remember that Baltimore one? Fortunately, it was a freight train. 1946, when the Bill Burton Act was passed, you had a lot of hospitals then devoted to polio and tuberculosis still. But you build up your community hospitals, your local county hospital or your district. Up until the 60s, you increase the number of hospitals. Then we had the last 25 years I just characterized. And I want to show something else. We know what D.C. General looks like, and people were referring to the way that Watts or Eleanor Holmes Norton would stand behind as if it was never shut down in front of the TV cameras. Look at this. This was taken yesterday by a photographer we have in the room here. This is a shutdown hospital. Look at this, Dr. Ali Muhammad. This is Winchester, Virginia. It's about seven stories high. They did build one towards the west of the county. It does have 500 beds, another one. But this is sitting there. Its power plant is intact. You see, it's the county of Frederick County in Virginia. Drive west here about 2 hours, okay? Just sitting there. In other counties in the country, there are similar things. Maybe the hospital was shut down and there was no other one. That's the point. Maybe another one was half built. We have one in Loudoun County. It's right in the downtown part of the city. sitting there empty. It had the Chamber of Commerce, a few beauty parlors or something, you know, this kind of space they talk about. But the point is, we can and should rebuild or reopen, as been discussed. And all around the country, we should take note. This is a question of frontline defense. Bring those beds back. They should be licensed. They need so much ratio of diagnostics and nurses and equipment. There's experts here in the audience. They know about that. That's the way we have to think again. And I just wanted to show you that picture of Winchester Hospital. It still exists downtown. You could be doing this around the country and up those available beds all around the nation where you need them. Now, where do you need them? I just want to show the way of thinking back. We're going back and forth in time. Go back again to the after that 1946 Hospital Construction Act. In the 1950s, there was still an idea, if you have infectious diseases still out there menacing us, let's study them and let's fight them. Congress, and that's what we've been talking about, we're going to get after again and set the agenda. They had 15 days of hearings in 1953, their trade commission, not on free trade and how you don't need factories or hospitals will import everything or will, you know, that kind of stuff. They had hearings on the causes, control, and remedies of the principal diseases of mankind. And they took a few each session. Here was on poliomyelitis. Another one was on tuberculosis. And they had a lot of testimony on D.C. because they had that. They had another session on chronic diseases of geriatrics and the aging. So this is a way of looking that has been... that we, in our fight, are restoring a whole way of thinking, not just for here, but for other parts of the country, where some of those places, you talk about the Dakotas or Iowa, you want to have a baby and you think you're going to have trouble, you have to drive 200 miles over three counties to find a place on time to get some help. Anyway, so what came out of this situation before was, in the 1950s, they looked at not just where the hospitals, but where do you need specialty things like cancer treatment centers or where do you need diagnostic centers? And that's from 1953. You'd want to know where the people are. Are they old? Are they young? I mean, you know, what are you going to treat? So that was a way of looking at things. That's the area of hospitals. And I think it's clear this is just a hand-drawn map. The urban, so you get back to the 1990s, you look at where you may have more AIDS to deal with and more potential for and reality of urban tuberculosis, then you'd need the specialty beds there. You'd need special wings. You need special wards. This is what we're fighting for, not just the community beds that you always have to have on hand. So that's the situation. And what this also has to do with now is we're talking about hospitals as the front line, but there's the question of staffing of all kinds. Hospitals imply physicians and nurses and laboratories and technicians and sanitation experts and centers for decontamination, as DC General had corridors and special wings. So the point is I'll just summarize where we stand today. This is from year 1999. It's the latest available figures. These bars refer to the total number, can you pull it over a little? Of public health workers. Now, I'm not talking about your hospital staff, but I mean epidemiologists, people who know about diseases, public health nurses who deal with questions of disease in school or kids get sick. The total number of public health workers per 100,000 people in the country, the latest tally, you have nationwide in different... around 156 public health workers of all kinds per 100,000 people. Do you know 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we didn't have 156. We had more like 200-something. Many more. There were more nurses just to check if a kid could hear or if there was lice or something we could do something about. These were taken down. And depending on where you live, these 10 districts refer to geography of the nation. We're thinking geographic tonight, right? Because that's how we think community, isn't it? Where's Brentwood, Northeast, New Jersey? Where, you know, you have to think that way. If you look at the Mid-Atlantic, where we are, there's 174 public health workers per 100,000 people. Out there in Chicago, in the Midwest, in the mountain states, they have way fewer. You have some bioterrorism or you just have some wreck in Chicago, they have many fewer. It's interesting than some of the East Coast. or the southern states, or up there around the Great Lakes. In the Northwest, it seems like there's a lot out in California or in Seattle, but a lot of them might be just dealing with helping babies and mothers and don't know anything about infectious diseases. So the staffing is a question of doing something about it. We want more people having those technicians, like at DC General, the full service, back in gear. You have also teach people there as students, as interns or student nurses or the technology people who could be deputized and in any emergency help act on things. So that's one area of infrastructure, the staffing. But let me just, because of the time, make a couple of quick points about food, water, and so forth. Because the public health is vulnerable there, but also we depend on things. The one thing we've had is in the last 25 years, especially now the last year we see DC General, where hospitals were allowed to be taken down saying, oh, it costs too much, there was allowed also to be in the basis of keeping costs low for your food. The idea your food can come from anywhere abroad, from South Africa, paying them nothing, or from Indonesia, or from, and also a few financial interests, like the ones behind the Washington Post, were very active internationally in merging food processing companies. You know the famous company that advertises a lot? They called ADM, Supermarket to the World. Archer Daniels Midland. ADM. This is a picture of their plant in Iowa, for example. They they're the biggest processor of soybeans in the world, one of the biggest of corn in the world. Now, you think corn, you think cornmeal. No, they make sugar out of it, and that's what goes into soda pop. And so. But this is corn milling and sweeteners. You take meat processing. Instead of a system where farmers were benefited and local manufacturers are benefited, like pork sausage in Baltimore or something like that, you have consolidation. 80-90% of some of your meat supply is concentrated in its production in only about 3 or 4 firms, in gigantic livestock lots and in gigantic meat processing plants. That means that at the same time, it's a potential for very readily spreadable bioterrorism, or just plain old E. coli bacteria. It doesn't have to be a fancier bacteria. And then you have these gigantic recalls of millions of pounds of meat or something like that. This has gone on in the last 35 years, and it's a threat against the well-being and a potential threat not just for bioterrorism, but you have more salmonella potential, more everything else, than if you have localities with food supply, food processing, and so forth.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
So that makes the point relatively quickly. And if we leave it in the last kind of, quickly looking at the last kind of couple of points, if you take the water situation in the United States, what happened is up until, I'll just put this on to make a quick view. Down at the bottom is just a little graph. It's over time. We're looking over time and looking over geography. You know the rainfall. We get a certain goodly amount in the East Coast. It's very dry out west. Well, in our whole hemisphere, it's dry in northwest Mexico and so forth. There was money spent. This is 1900 to 1970. And this is spending on U.S. water projects over the last century. They tended to go up, especially in the 40s, when during the 30s, the Franklin Roosevelt period, they built the Grand Coulee Dam. They built these other dams. They were adding to the water supply and waterworks. But in the last 30 years, this stops in 1970, it's gone way down. Look at the state of the reservoirs and the waterworks. In cities or in county areas, the spending, this is just dollar spending in billions of dollars, has gone down in water supply, in flood control, in navigation. So we don't have really built-up systems. Here's a project that was never built out west. We're here in the east, and we have decrepit old cities. Look at the potholes blowing. Excuse me, manhole covers blowing up. We didn't build the big projects in the west that were buildable. This is one. The yellow shows where you could run water down from plentiful supplies in northwest Canada, and you could bring it through the Great Plains. These were discussed in Congress in the 1950s and 60s. Then Shell, too expensive, we can't do it. So now you have water shortages. You also have, this is fun, it's not in D.C., but it's when, it's in Broadway, New York City, Broadway, when the water mains broke and they actually lost some cars. So you have a real situation where you haven't been developing the resource base, and you have a situation where, without going into it in the same detail, but I'll make a point about anthrax. In our whole nation, over the relevant time period, this is the 1960s to the 1990s, instead of increasing the generation capacity of electricity in our nation so that you wouldn't anticipate high rising bills, like with the gas bill and everything else, we haven't been adding to our generation capacity. Besides having a lot of high-priced sharks come in and buy it all out, like Dominion Resources or the gas companies and so forth, Enron. But apart from that, do you know that when they were testing the anthrax down there in CDC, which is based in Atlanta, Georgia, the electricity went out for an hour, and it set them back about a half a day. And the other thing is Centers for Disease Control, based in Atlanta, Georgia, they have about 20 buildings. Some of them were built after the Second World War, and they were supposed to be replaced in 10 years, and they're still using them. They have duct tape taped around. They have fantastic equipment, but they're worried about water from the roof leaking in. This is the and someone else can verify this kind of thing. So, and this is the national front line, Centers for Disease Control, let alone counties that should likewise have, we just talked about, a local disease expert in every county, every 3,064 county. So that's the kind of point about this. And one final point then, because, you know, we're here in the district, we know it, we're here, we see it, we're up against, Lynn just gave the report and so forth. But if you look at what our fight means and what Congress means, they're here, as soon as we can get at them again, that if you take some of these counties in the country where they shut down the hospital and so forth, and you're supposed to drive, it's like telling you in town, you could report on this, oh, it's okay, just go to something across town. You can't get there, you don't have the money, you don't have car fare, there's no transit, you can't, right? Well, this is the railroad system, because many cities, because you know what happened with airplanes. So you look around, what happened to the rail system? This is 1950, this is 1997, same to the present. The amount of railroad mileage that was still in use per 1,000 households of our country, of our population, you have to look at it that way, went down. Track was taken out all over the place. It was taken out coming into D.C. It was taken out across Nebraska. One-third of Nebraska lost all its track. So you couldn't, you're out there, you can't, say you're really sick. It could be your friend could take you to the hospital on a train if there was still a train. But the trains aren't there. The county hospitals aren't there. And D.C. General is the flagship fight for that whole thing in the nation, which is a front line against all disease. Now, let me end with this. I'm sorry. I just have to show you this. Because I mentioned by thinking sanitation, sometimes it's good for us in the middle of the fight to step back and look at the kind of things we're done. This isn't for nostalgia, but there was an evolution. We're here today in this room, and we've lost people over the years, or there's been some real suffering and real lives lost in past decades. But think back around 100 years. You want to see what a disinfectant looked like? Because we should have everything we need in the way of disinfection. This is a portable steam disinfector used during the yellow fever epidemic. Okay, this was state-of-the-art at the time. This is a big steam engine, and here's some hooks, and you'd hang whatever you're going to disinfect. What would you hang? Your equipment and your medical things you look at people with. And then you go in there, and you shut the door and crank up the steam engine, and you disinfect it. But we should do whatever state-of-the-art we have to do. That's the whole point. Here's the kind of thing that they've been talking about, although the Postmaster General. This is a food irradiation, you can't see it that well. See that atomic symbol. You could bring mail, or you can bring medical equipment, but this is for food on pallets. And then it goes up here, and then it goes in a big chamber. And you can kill all the bacteria in that. That'll kill. That's a food irradiation bacteria killer. And people say, oh, it's too much money. Look, you know, they had steam engine disinfect. We can do what we have to do. The money needs to be spent on the facilities, the training, the manpower needs to be restored, and the machinery and the equipment. Since we're on this subject, let me just show another example. This is mailroom disinfection in, what's the year, 1880 to 1900. When the mail was going by train, and that would have been yellow fever microbe or what. But you have different things. This was in the South. The U.S. postal carriers, mail passengers, and boxcars would go to a mail fumigation station, and they would disinfect. So everybody would wait outside, and it was done by the U.S. Marine Hospital Service. But let me tell you who Marine is. The Public Health Service, I don't know where their buildings are, but there's symbol is an anchor, because the origin, prior even to DC General Hospital in around 1798, was that at all the ports of entry of the new country, where you need it, build a hospital to take care of the seamen. They often have been exposed to foreign diseases around the world, and otherwise take care of them, because why shouldn't you take care of them? They did their service and they deserve care. So that's the who would do this. So these would be the rail cars being fumigated. Then you had other things. People complain about security checks. This is around 1900 during the yellow fever epidemic. If you wanted to leave Florida to get away from the fever and go into Georgia, you had to stop over for 6 days and stay in an inoculation hut. Excuse me, an incubation hut. This was a camp, a detention camp. And it's on the border, and it was 1888, 6 days. Now, a lot of this came out direct out of the military. And, of course, Walter Reed Hospital is named after the big fighter of disease of the time period. And, of course, look at Walter Reed. I understand over the last 10 years they've shut 1,000 beds. They have, that kind of thing. But the experience, there is the experience there. If we can enforce the approach of do what's necessary, pay the bill, then what does it mean? It means the answer to what otherwise people are talking about is, oh, how can we have a stimulus? It's perfectly clear that the jobs you would be creating to restore and build this picture, this kind of system, with all these different features, you have a tremendous shortage of jobs. That's what happens. When I was here in August, before the September 11th, events occurred, and before anthrax, this is the very thing I showed, because the figures had come out for July, that the announced layoffs, I think over here, went off the chart. And because we were talking about the situation, that the economy wasn't going to last. We're fighting a fight for public health, but we're in the midst of the economy. The layoffs, 1997, 98, 2000, went off the charts. And, of course, most people, since they're only working part-time, are getting no unemployment insurance. So we are set, even without bioterrorism, for degrees of nutritional collapse, resurgence of tuberculosis from people who have it there, but it's been kept dormant, even without bioterrorism. So it's either build this stuff or die, and we're in a tremendous leading position. So I think that's the reason you talk about sanitation. I mean, it's talking about actually the state of the economy and the resource base of a real public health system. Thanks.
And now we feature a continuation of the dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche at the Labor Day 2001 conference here in Northern Virginia.
I've been following the former Yugoslavia for quite a while, since before the breakup, well, before the war, when the breakup was first happening, and I could never really understand why they broke it up and why Bush recognized Bosnia right off the bat, and it seems like it's been nothing but trouble ever since. Was there a good reason to break up Yugoslavia? That's my question.
You had a process, a complicated process, in which, in the course of the First World War, there was an agreement to put this area of South Slav area into a Yugoslavia, which is a synthetic nation created under the umbrella of the Versailles Treaty. The control over Yugoslavia until the World War II was entirely controlled by Anglo-French intelligence services. French and British intelligence controlled Yugoslavia, and they controlled the monarchy. In the course of the Second World War, you had a mixed deal in which Tito became the leader, effectively, of Yugoslavia in the course of the war, and at the end, was playing a game in between the Soviet government and the British and French governments. In the post-war period, the problem in Yugoslavia was primarily British through the Bertrand Russell group and similar kinds of people, intelligence-wise. The second part was French military intelligence. When the, at the 1989, in order to prevent Europe from being united effectively with the breakup of the Comecon, Thatcher, the British, supported by the French President Mitterrand, and with the complicity of George Bush, set up agreements under the heading of keep the Germans down and the Russians out, in which the Anglo-Americans, with their French lackeys, decided that the Anglo-Americans were going to set up a world empire. This is the process leading to what's called globalization. These powers rigged the currencies of the world, controlled the IMF and so forth, looted everything in sight with financial swindles, and generally became the predator living upon the rest of the world as the prey. Other measures were taken. Measure number one, the war against Iraq, which was organized by Anglo-American intelligence, especially by the British, and George Bush did as Thatcher ordered, though she left before the war was quite completed, 1990. As soon as Desert Storm was slowed down to a perpetual ulcer, the Anglo-French crowd organized the Balkan Wars. And that's how they were organized. In a more recent period, with the H.G. Wells phenomenon of various people, including Madeleine Hoffbright, Albright, Nobright, whatever, and the British, they organized a new phase which became known as the Yugoslav War. At that point, the United States took over a bigger position there, and of what I can see, the British and the United States government, through their military arms, are running a new phase of the war involving Macedonia, Albania, and so forth, as a result of the KLA setup. And other wars are possible in that region. So the whole history, which has a much deeper history in terms of the history of the... This goes back to the Emperor Diocletian, before the founding of Constantinople, when Diocletian in Illyria was running the Roman Empire. And then he set the process of breaking the Roman Empire up into parts and created a code. And his protege, Constantine, became the head of the new Byzantine Empire, established on a division between east and western part of the Roman Empire set up by Diocletian. And since that time, the entire history of the Balkans has always been to play the Balkans as an east-west conflict and north-south conflict, always orchestrated by whoever was the world imperial power dominating the Mediterranean at that time. That's been the consistent history of the area. So, yes, there were problems, there were issues, there were ethnic issues, there were ethnic divisions, there were religious divisions and so forth. These issues existed. These issues did not cause the war. The war, as opposed to the issues, was caused by the Anglo-American Anglo-French operations, assisted by increasing complicity by U.S. forces.
Next person is Freddie Coronel.
Hello, Lynn. My name is Freddie, and I'm from Los Angeles. My question was, it had to deal with the organization, and especially the time period that we're in right now, in terms of the crash already being here. I see this especially not only in our office, but I'm sure this happens throughout the whole United States region. All this, most of these selfishness and image. You know, we all have the tendency to put this image on ourselves. And this whole question of agape, we have to function as a unit to be more effective in the organizing and to actually bring upon a stronger change than we have now. And not only in our office, but I'm sure all over the United States, is that we've been lacking in that. I mean, we can talk the talk. We go out there and we say, we have to function as a unit, we have to love people and all this, and yet they really haven't developed in themselves. So they have that block right there, they have that limit within themselves. And in a sense, I don't know if it's now, but how do we get rid of that? How do we work towards to get rid of this image, and how do we get rid of towards this feeling selfish or feeling threatened by another person's development? How do we just stop being spoiled, basically? How do we just get rid of all these little materialistic things that have really no relevance to the universe and what we have to do right now? But actually, feel it totally. Not just, I myself am pretty much working towards that, right? And yet, and I'm sure others are as well. But when in doing that, it's like Plato talks about nailing, and I forget which dialogue it was, but about nailing your soul to feel a certain way, right? And especially when we're trying to reach this kind of love, when it feels like when I'm nailing my soul to feel that love, it's like, why am I nailing my soul if this should be some kind of thing that should automatically be there and I wouldn't have to question it? And with all these people, I think if they actually try to achieve that, and we'd actually function more as a unit and be more effective out in the field, not only that, but actually bring upon a change that's needed all over the world right now, and especially with your leadership. Yesterday when I heard you speak, it was just more of a change than I had in the past, and more of a change in my way of viewing you and this whole organization, your leadership and your power. And, if you're taking leadership right now, we are pretty much not only an army, but not only a family, but just the whole world pretty much lies on us and what we're going to do. And you're already doing it, but we have to be more effective. But how... Hello? But just how? How do we just go about bringing that?
First of all, under all conditions, at all times, no matter whether it's a threat to society or not, a human being should, if they wish to enjoy being themselves, should care for the whole human race at all times, under all conditions. Because, as what I said earlier on this question of the question of identity, if you want to be fully yourself, knowing that we're all going to die, how can you become fully yourself unless you fulfill yourself in a way that is not destroyed by your death? How can you go to the grave in peace and joy? Just accepting it as inevitable, not as something you desire to do tomorrow morning. Actually, you should try to live as long as possible. I don't care what pain you have, what suffering you have, live as long as possible. It's important. But that war we're going to lose eventually. But there's another war we need not lose. the war of our identity as human beings, our cognitive identity, our relationship to people, minds of the past, and our relationship to the future. So what is most important to you as you walk through life each day? It's the future. It's doing justice for the past. Someone made a great discovery in the past. You know it. The discovery was never really fully utilized by mankind. You act to cause that discovery made by a person long dead to finally come into use and benefit for humanity. You have changed the past. You've changed past history by changing its outcome. You live for the outcome of the future. So therefore, if you wish to develop, as you express this desire, to perfect oneself as a human being, then you wish to be primarily a person, an individual, who is in some way indispensable to all other human beings. And how do you make yourself indispensable? By making yourself useful. How do you make yourself useful? By doing something for others. Not just gifts as material gifts, but giving them something which helps them to realize their own personal identity. In the same way you want an identity. An identity which is still important to humanity after you're dead. So therefore, when you're dealing with a person in organizing, you make a mistake if you do not consider the objective, the mission of your intervention with that person, to make them a better person. Huh? To make them a better person by touching upon them a potentiality to increase their capacity to realize themselves, which is not merely something you take a diploma and walk away, I realize this, I realize that. The capacity essentially is they see a mission or a role in a mission, which is required because of what they are or what they wish to be. That's how they perfect themselves. I mean, for example, what does a good teacher do? A good teacher in a classroom, what does it do with the students? A good teacher in a classroom with the students engages the students in doing something they may have some difficulty in doing, to compel students to actually re-experience a discovery of principle. So they are organizing that student or that group of students. They're organizing them by getting them to develop in themselves a power which they lack, but a potential, through a potential which they have. Now, mission means, well, either you should do that, because that's your mission, or it's something we must cooperate to do together. When you say organizing is I'm trying to get somebody to do something, the words are not wrong, but they're a little bit tricky. Are you trying to get your personal satisfaction in success in organizing, or are you trying to create some benefit in which these will participate? In other words, you're doing something for them. So your motivation in organizing, which will overcome the kind of problem you refer to, which does arise in people, is to get beyond selfishness by not being selfish. Not being selfish is not just giving things to people or withholding things from people or taking things from people. Being not selfish means that you're concerned about their soul. Not the soul in the abstract way that some idiot like Pat Robertson was talking about it, but in the sense of they are a person who is going to die. What is going to be important about their life? And what's important about the life is the mission which stands immediately before them, the most important thing. It's like the man who had this thing in tragedy, of the man who has given a challenge and he turns away from it. And his life is spoiled because he turned away from something which was an opportunity to do good. It's a thing of shame that hangs around his neck that he turned away when he could have done some good. And this is what you see. You have to be concerned about the inside, the soul of the other person in that sense. And then you don't have a problem. Even if you don't know what the answer is, the very fact that you're willing to work and dedicate yourself to try to bring that result about, that's good. And as long as you're trying to do good in that sense, you're not wrong. You know, this, you have this Cotton Mather, one of the great founders of this nation, wrote a book or paper on to do good. A student of Mather's work, Benjamin Franklin, wrote on the subject of to do good. The principle of life is to do good. And if you are committed to do good and cooperate with somebody else so that you together can do good that you might not be able to do separately, that's real organizing. And you have nothing to worry about selfishness.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.